This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Arizona State University, with more than 70 campus degrees to choose from offered 100% online with 6 start dates a year. Learn more at online.asu.edu.
Pay attention to this number, everybody. You're going to need it in about a minute and a half. 2,256 days. Here's a hint if you need it. Janet Yellen from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Epson, workforce all-in-one printers for business powered by Precision Core Technology. Workforce printers for home offices, small offices, and network work groups. Epson.com. And by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. And by CIT, providing commercial lending, leasing, and advisory services to small and middle market businesses for over 100 years. More at CIT.com.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday, gang. It's the 18th of February, and if it's all right with you, we'll begin today with a quiz. It's about monetary policy, so interest rates and the Federal Reserve. Here is the question. How long has the main short-term interest rate that the Fed controls, it's known as the federal funds rate, how long has it been at basically zero? Anybody? Anybody? Counting today, 6 years, 2 months, and 3 days, the aforementioned 2,256 days, which is, any way you count it, a long time, right? That's why every twitch the central bank makes toward raising rates gets a whole lot of attention. I told you that so I could tell you this. We got the minutes from the Fed's most recent meeting today, the one they held back at the end of January. Suffice it to say that Chair Janet Yellen and the gang are a bit cautious, not only about when to start tightening monetary policy, as it's known, but also even about how to talk about it. Remember all the hullabaloo a couple of meetings ago when Yellen started using one very particular word?
The committee judges that it can be patient.
That last one, patient, as in the Fed will be patient before raising rates. Here's a quote from today's minutes. It is literally a quote. It's Fed speak, so look out. Many participants regarded dropping the patient language whenever that might occur as risking a shift in market expectations, end quote. So slow and steady wins the monetary policy race, I guess, is the moral of that story. All right, so now on to slightly less macroeconomic news, but all the same, news that the Fed will surely be studying. There was a bunch of data out today, a bunch of indicators, none taken in isolation terribly noteworthy, but if you bundle them all up, they tell an economic story worth a mention or two. Item number one, industrial production. It was up 0.2% last month, a bit less than people had been guessing. Housing starts were down in January as well, and the tanking price of oil gave producer prices, that is, inflation at the wholesale level, the biggest month-over-month drop they have had in 5 years. So Marketplace's Adam Allington set out to see whether the upswing that we have been reporting on for some time now is still on track. Here's Adam.
The first quarter of 2015 is not starting out with a bang. But come on, half the country's either buried under snow or too cold to think about spending all that extra gas money we're carrying around.
there's no way to recoup some of the wages lost in areas where you just couldn't get to work because of the weather.
Diane Swank is the chief economist at Mesirow Financial. She says the cold weather has slowed home building. An ongoing strike by longshoremen on the West Coast is also holding things up.
You know, suppliers, retailers, a lot of people who can't get the goods they need to distribute them. All of this disrupts and displaces economic activity.
Producer prices are falling, which means it's cheaper for manufacturers to make stuff, which can actually hold back economic activity. But Justin Wolfers isn't worrying.
The decline in producer prices is actually hiding a good thing. It's driven by declining oil prices.
Wolfers is an economist at the University of Michigan. Overall, he says he's still bullish on the U.S. economy.
The most reliable data we have says that firms have been hiring and hiring pretty rapidly. So I think there's probably at least as many people worried that the economy is growing too fast as those who think we're on the cusp of a downturn anytime soon.
Wolfers points out that other indicators, such as unemployment, continue to trend well. Diane Lim is an economist at the Committee for Economic Development. She says the big issue facing economists is just trying to figure out what normal data looks like.
I mean, I definitely think we shouldn't panic about the new normal not being the same as the old normal. That doesn't mean it's a bad normal.
Did you get that? Basically, what Lim is saying is that the recession changed household behavior around housing and spending, and we might just have to wait a little while to say precisely how. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Line of the day right there. The new normal is not necessarily a bad normal. On Wall Street today, some of this, some of that. Come see, come sign. You know the drill. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Disappearing texts, it seems, can make a whole lot of zeros appear after a dollar sign. Snapchat, the company that made its name by making texts and pictures disappear once they've been seen, is said to be looking for another round of venture capital funding, a round that would value the startup at $19 billion with a B dollars. That's basically double the valuation that Snapchat had just a year ago. Marketplace's Nova Sappho explains how the heck that math works.
Here's one thing that's changed.
We don't know how much they've grown their audience, but my guess would be is that it's big.
That's Julie Ask of Forrester Research. We don't know because Snapchat won't publicly say. There are guesses, though, of anywhere between 100 to 200 million current users. The key is that the audience is thought to be young, millennials, teens.
There is scarcity of companies and options out there that have audiences as large as someone like a Snapchat.
So Ask says it's a seller's market. Investors are buying into those few companies that do have large audiences and coveted demographics, just in case some of them actually figure out how to make money.
Well, Snapchat has figured out a monetization model.
And that's the second thing that's changed, says Brian Solis of Altimeter Group. Snapchat is now selling ads and has content channels with news and entertainment.
They understand the psychology of teenage engagement and communication.
But Paul Kodrowski isn't buying any of this.
Were I to be a Snapchat shareholder, I would be very happy selling to the people who are buying at $19 billion.
Kodrowski is a technology equity analyst and an investor through his firm SK Ventures.
People forget, but Snapchat is really only a 3.5-year-old company that's risen, you know, very, very quickly on the back of teens largely moving away from some of the more orthodox social media services like Facebook, for example.
And when parents follow those teens to Snapchat like they did to Facebook, Kodrowski says, what's to say those teens won't move on once again? In New York, I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
The Federal Communications Commission just wrapped up a public comment period on 5G, or what the FCC likes to refer to as bringing the U.S. to the forefront of 5G wireless technology. We've got Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech, on the line to explain what that is all about. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Kai.
Make me smart here, man. 5G. I would say spell it out for me, but that's a bad joke. What is it?
All right. Wait, before we go there, Kai.
Yes.
Let's go to the original G, the OG, if you will.
OG. Okay.
G stands for generation, right?
Okay, yep.
And the original Gs, they were about voice service, right?
Yes.
We wanted voice on our cell phones. That's the really old school original G.
Yes.
But eventually we wanted more than that, right? We wanted data. We wanted texting.
Yes.
So we got texting on, you know, 2G. Then we wanted the actual internet, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we got 3G.
Okay.
And Kai, what's on your phone? If you look on your phone.
I don't bring my phone in the studio, but I have 4G.
You're up to date, man.
I am, yo.
Yeah. So 4G is faster internet access. It's
okay.
Basically like right. You can stream videos, you know, your properly pronounced GIFs, things like that.
Hey-ho, hey-ho, it's GIFs, but let's not go there.
LTE, you've probably heard of as
I
well,
have,
right?
Yes.
And for our purposes, basically, we'll call that 4G. The same
okay.
thing, right?
All right?
5G is the next generation. It's going to be pretty different.
How?
It's better, right? That's the basic thing. It's better. It promises really high speeds. But the interesting thing is it promises higher speeds, but for shorter distances. Think meters, not miles, right?
Oh, that's not good.
Right.
So
exactly.
we need more base stations.
Yes,
yes,
we need more base stations. They're smaller, smaller circles of coverage, for instance. Now, the good thing about this is that it means you could actually have a trash can or a lamppost be a base station for a 5G cellular network.
Hmm.
But 5G is not here yet. We're a couple years away. And so companies are trying to do other things in the meantime to get better service.
All right, wait, hang on. If we're going to have trash cans and light poles be some of these, you know, transmitters or whatever, right?
Yeah.
That's
capital
outlay by the cell phone providers. So companies are going to have to spend more money for this, which means we are going to pay more money for 5G. That's always the way it works, yeah?
It is true.
Yes.
But in the meantime, Kai, companies
yes.
are doing something that's actually good for companies and good for the user.
All right.
And that is they are starting to do this thing that's basically a Wi-Fi first approach. So you've heard of like Google offering
yeah, yeah.
its own wireless
Wi-Fi
service.
Phones, yeah.
Yep. And these other wireless services that are doing this sort of thing. What that means is that it can be really cheap for us to get all of that data that we want because they're basically offloading the data hogs onto their own Wi-Fi networks at home or their Wi-Fi networks at work, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you don't want to be on a Wi-Fi-only phone when you're, like, out in the middle of the woods. That's
a horror
film setup. If you move out of your home's Wi-Fi signal
right.
area, you actually lose your signal and you lose your data. And so in many ways, I think 5G is going to be way better, even though it's still small coverage area. It's going to be essential in the future because people move. And that's the whole point of having a smartphone or a cell phone.
Very quickly, before I let you go, how long until the 5G future gets here?
5 years. 5G, 5 years. That's what I'm saying, Kai. That's
okay.
my number.
Ben John, and you're sticking to it. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. Thank you, Ben.
You got it, Kai.
Coming up, the first assistant director. Nothing happens on a movie set without one, however.
When they talk about the glamour of movie making, I don't know if people associate it with that.
Oscars, unsung heroes. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials reversed a 10% today, about 17 points, closed at 18,029. The S&P 500 basically flat, lost less than a point, did the S&P, finished at 2,099. The NASDAQ picked up a 10%, 7 points, ended things at 49.06. Minutes from the Fed's latest meeting are out, as I said, and the takeaway on raising rates is, wait for it, patience. See what we did there? Bank of America still gave up 2%. Morgan Stanley withdrew 1.5%. Internet stocks went the other way. Angie's List, oh my, skyrocketed 58% after reporting, yes, as always, better than expected. Earnings at Zillow up 14%. I wish my house price did the same. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.08%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Kronos, offering cloud-based workforce management solutions designed to help organizations of all types and sizes maximize one of their biggest investments, their workforce. Kronos.com. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. And by Allianz, sponsor of the new Love Family Money Study, an in-depth look at how modern families balance emotional support with financial realities. You can see what they learned at AllianzUSA.com. And by Condor Airlines, introducing new service from Portland, Oregon and Providence, Rhode Island. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Have something to say about one of our stories or want to suggest your own? Find us on Twitter at Marketplace or join us on Facebook to interact with producers, reporters, and the hosts of Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. We've got both ends of the retail spectrum covered. Walmart and Nordstrom announced quarterly earnings. In New York City, we've come to the end of the catwalk. Fashion Week wraps. And the year of the sheep begins. Or is it the year of the goat? Either way, happy Chinese New Year. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Well, we're all familiar with the phrase working off debt, yes? What if you turn that around, though, and make it working to have less debt? That's the theory behind what are known as work colleges. There are just a couple of them around the country, including a new one this week, the Paul Quinn College, a historically black college in Dallas, Texas. Tim Fitzsimmons has the story.
Work colleges are not work study. That's a federal program that helps students afford college with part-time work. It's more than that.
If the students did not show up to work, our campuses would not operate.
Robin Taffler is executive director of the Work Colleges Consortium.
The really key piece here is the fact that work is mandatory for all students. You can't buy your way out of the program.
The students are the school's security guards, janitors, IT staff, and gardeners. The school saves on staffing costs, gets some federal grant money, and the students get an education for a lot less. Sometimes it's even free. Bruce Brinson is the CFO of Paul Quinn College. He says their roughly 225 students often had trouble affording school. He says the change will mean a big tuition cut.
For a full-time on-campus student, from just under $24,000 a year to just over $14,000 a year. And that's radical in and of itself.
So could this model be rolled out more widely? It's not as simple as it sounds. The work program is like an academic program in that it has administrators and costs.
Most of them probably could never pull it off.
Chris Larson is dean of work education at the College of the Ozarks, another work college.
Like I said, because it costs so much money, many schools look to get into it because typically they're in a difficult financial situation and looking to cut costs or looking to cut staff. And they think, okay, we'll just have students work. But it doesn't work that way.
So it's one more way of making college cheaper. But to make it work, you have to work. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
The United Network for Organ Sharing says 24,383 lives were saved last year through organ donation. Expensive though the surgery is, organ donation can also save money in the long run. Unless it turns out you're a living donor. Marketplace's Sabri Benishul reports transplant surgeons and volunteers are looking for ways to reduce that burden.
Keith Brink's kidneys have failed him.
Pretty wore out, run down. With my blood this toxic, my short-term memory is kind of non-existent.
Brinks is, of course, only one out of 101,511 people waiting for a new kidney. About 17% of them will actually get one this year, and around 4,500 will die waiting. There is one person who is able to help Keith Brinks right now.
Pretty nervous, pretty anxious, a little scared.
And that is his sister, Melissa.
When I met the surgeon, they told me last minute that they were going to take a rib out. So I guess a lot of pain is what I'm expecting. and I don't know, like 5 days in the hospital. So, you know, I'm doing this because I love my brother.
She will pay a price for doing so, beyond the half a pound of flesh and bone she is giving up from her abdomen. She won't be able to work for 2 months.
6 to 8 weeks or so, just depending on how I'm feeling after I get out of the hospital.
Brinks goes out of her way to say how much she loves her bosses, but the fact is she doesn't get sick days.
At first, it was figuring out what I was going to do with my job. I clean carpets. And then how am I going to pay for my bills?
On top of that, Brinks had to travel from Iowa to Arkansas for pre-op appointments just to make sure she could donate. She had to find childcare for her son when she was away and will have to do it again during the surgery and her recovery. On average, it costs $3,000 to $5,000 for living donors like Melissa Brinks to donate their kidney.
Not everybody has employer-provided paid time off and vacation and sick time.
Dr. Robert Marion is president of Arbor Research Collaborative for Health, a nonprofit research group.
That's 4 to 6 weeks that you're going to be generating no income for your family, no rent money, no money to put food on the table, and so on. And our health insurance system doesn't provide a way for that to be covered.
Neither does the government. Alan Langness, a past president of the American Society of Transplant Surgeons, says he has an idea why.
There are people in the government who still have reservations. And so it makes them a little uncomfortable to overly promote living donation.
And Langness says it's not about money.
For many years, you know, many people were just full on against living donation, period. Just the idea that you would take somebody who's perfectly healthy and operate on them and take out one of their kidneys.
In the private sector, transplant doctors say there's confusion about whether it's even legal to reimburse someone for expenses. Congress outlawed payment for organs in 1984 out of fear of creating a market. But it carved out an exception for paying a person's expenses and lost wages. Not all transplant centers and hospitals got the memo. Melissa Brinks Hospital didn't.
And they, you know, tell you, well, there's laws that you can't receive money from the recipient, so... And I really don't know the laws.
This misinformation, coupled with the lack of substantial financial support for many donors, has its consequences.
My friend died.
Sigrid Fry Revere is a bioethicist and would have been an organ donor.
Because I personally got excluded as a living donor simply because I didn't have enough resources.
Her friend would have paid to help her with expenses, but she was also told she couldn't receive any money in any way from the donor.
These people are dying, you know, needlessly.
There is a government program for some expenses for low-income donors, and Fry Revere herself started a small foundation, the American Living Organ Donation Fund, to help people. But Fry Revere says the federal government needs to do more to help living donors as opposed to deceased ones.
The incentive has always been to establish better and more deceased organ donation.
Medicare pays $50,000 to $70,000 to organizations that procure kidneys from dead donors, but Fry Revere says deceased donors don't come close to meeting the need.
Fewer than 1% of the U.S. population dies under conditions where organs can be retrieved. So even if every single American signed their donor card, we would never have enough.
She says if the focus switched to fully covering living donors, we'd have more organs and save money. That's because Medicare covers end-stage kidney disease, regardless of age, and transplants are more cost-effective than dialysis. Some studies predict a savings of $100,000 for each transplant. Back in Arkansas, Keith Brinks knows exactly what he's asking of his sister.
It's asking a lot from her.
And he is grateful.
I got real lucky. If it wasn't for my sister coming along, the transplant definitely extended my life.
For now, though, people willing to give up their flesh to save a life must also be able to give up thousands of dollars, which many doctors say means there are simply more people out there who want to donate than there are people who are financially able to. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Short of the actual Best Picture Award, one of the top-tier Oscars is the one for Best Director.
The winner, when the statuettes are handed out Sunday night, will get lots of press. But there is a whole roster of people, people whose names few know, without whom an Oscar-winning director, or any other director for that matter, would never even get to that bit where they say, action. I'm talking here about assistant directors, known in the trade as ADs. So continuing our series today on the unsung heroes of the Oscars, Vince Palmo. He was the first AD on Boyhood. Vince, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
So for those not necessarily hip to Hollywood hierarchy, what exactly is it that you do as a first assistant director?
Try to make everything in place so that on the day, all the director has to say is action and cut. So we schedule. That's probably my favorite part of the whole process is scheduling.
Like, do you schedule actors and cameras and extras and all that stuff?
All that stuff. We interact with every department. As soon as camera's ready, the actors are ready, the background's ready. The director has to do as little as possible.
which somehow doesn't seem fair that he has to, or she has to do as little as possible.
Well, they're answering thousands upon thousands of questions within that process. And we're like the first line of support for the director and stuff. So
I imagine for a film like Boyhood shot over, you know, whatever it was, that 12 years, your job must have been a nightmare.
It was an adventure because we kind of didn't know each year exactly when we'd be shooting, you know, depending on actor availability and everything. It was the first thing that I actually firsted. I had worked with Rick.
This is Linklater, the director of Boyhood, Richard Linklater.
Correct. I had worked with Rick a couple of times as a second and stuff. And maybe in that regard, it was a little daunting. But
where does it end? Do you have fourth ADs and fifth ADs and all that? Or at some point, do you just become a gopher?
You become a production
assistant.
Production
assistant, right.
You become a PA, yeah. Yeah. That's where I started. I started as a production assistant.
You got to work your way up, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you have directorial aspirations? I mean, it would seem that that is the next logical career progression, right?
Yes. it is the next logical progression. I do, but man, it's a big leap. It's a big leap. It's like a nurse saying she'd like to be, or he would like to be a doctor. Huh. So it's a big step.
Did you know, by the way, that there used to actually be an Academy Award for assistant directors?
No.
Yeah,
did there really?
Back in the 30s for like 3-4 years.
Wow. That must have been before there was a Directors Guild, I'm thinking.
Probably, right? Because you know how the directors get.
Yeah.
You ought to start the petition to bring it back. It was 1933 to 1937, in case you're curious.
I don't know. That could be the part of the show or the ceremony where people decide to go to the kitchen or... And when they talk about the glamour of movie making, I don't know if people associate it with that.
Vince Palmo, he was the first AD, as they say in the trades, on Boyhood. Thanks very much, Vince, for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
This final note on the way out, in which we return to the hardest working woman in monetary policy, Fed Chair Janet Yellen, of course. Using Dr. Yellen's official calendar, the Wall Street Journal tallied up exactly how much time she spent in meetings last year and with whom. It is, I'll tell you, kind of daunting. Starting on the day she was sworn in, that was February 3rd last year, Yellen had more than 950 meetings, sometimes as many as 11 in a single day. I can't imagine anything worse. There is, though, all kinds of fascinating stuff in there. Like on December 2nd last year, she met with Jamie Dimon, the CEO of the biggest bank in the country, of course, JPMorgan Chase, from 1:30 to 2:30 in the afternoon. If you're curious, we do have the link online. You can check it out. It is marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by the Financial Times, providing in-depth global comment and analysis on the latest international business, economic, and political news. The Financial Times, prepare to read beyond the expected. And by Epson, with workforce all-in-one printers for business powered by Precision Core Technology. Workforce printers designed for home and offices and work groups. Epson.com.
And by Malwarebytes, engineered to deliver a smart defense against zero-day malware, exploits, and ransomware for business, for home. More at malwarebytes.org/marketplace.
On Wall Street today, on the way out, just to refresh, the Dow off a 10%, about 17 points. The Nasdaq picked up a 10%, 7 points. S&P 500 basically flat, down less than a point, technically. Caitlin Ash, Millie Jefferson, and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.